Because my mouth is wide with laughter, and my throat is deep with song, you do not think I suffer after I have held my pain so long? Because my mouth is wide with laughter, you do not hear my inner cry? Because my feet are gay with dancing, you do not know I die?
This is Bob Kerr with the Record Collector Show, and our guest is an old friend of the program again, Ed Crommelin of Vancouver, who is able to constantly surprise us with anything from operatic to lowdown jazz. And I believe that he's going to introduce the program via the voice of Paul Robeson, we've just heard. Tell us about it, Ed.
That's correct, Bob. Reason why I picked this little poem by Langston Hughes, which Paul Robeson recited here, is that what he expresses in the poem is exactly my personal feeling about jazz. It is very happy on the outside, but deep down in the soul, which really counts, it is blues and jazz with feeling.
This counts for more than just the blues. It's
general feel of jazz. That's correct.
Now, what's the general content of the program going to be
it
then?
It is jazz, white jazz, of white orchestras, and from fairly old to fairly recent. We go back to the first recording, 1926, and I took there a recording by Red Nichols as a soloist, which is quite rare. And this particular record is quite rare because it was issued with a book of instructions for new trumpeters. And this is 1925, and Red Nichols just explained in the book how to play trumpet in jazz, with all the vibrato, licks, breaks,
coughs
and what have you. And in order to play it well, you had to read this book as a trumpeter and try to play it at home, and then correct yourself by playing this recording back. It is called Plenty of Center.
muta bit's very attractive, isn't it?
Yes, I like that part.
Anyway. Well, that's a disc called Plenty of Center, featuring Red Nichols in the cornet, and 1925 or 6, was it?
1925. The book came out in 1926. Oh. It was published with the recording.
Now, I've never seen this label before.
No, Salabert. This is from France. Oh. And this is the issue in Europe. I don't know if it ever was published in the States as such. If so, it must have been on a perfect label. But I don't know.
One other thing before we play the next one. Did any of these people, Red Nichols and that kind of music, go over live to Europe during your days of activity over in Europe before the war?
Red Nichols did not, as far as I know, but many other musicians, yes, and I think I met most of them. Jimmy Dorsey, mm-hmm. Ted Lewis, Eddie Lang, Joe Venuti.
They all went over there.
Yeah, Vix Beiderbecke never
did. But usually think of this as so terribly indigenous to the States that they never got out, you know.
Oh, yes.
Now, let's go on to the next one, then.
The next one is a New Orleans Rhythm Kings recording. Now, that orchestra became very famous amongst jazz musicians because the first recordings of jazz were made by a white band, the original Dixieland Jazz Band, in May 1917. But they were still too much attached to the novelty item of jazz. And they never broke through to the art as such, I would say. And the first white orchestra that managed to reach the Negro idiom for jazz was this New Orleans Rhythm Kings. And part of the reason was a fantastic good clarinet player by the name of Leon Rapolo. Now, this gentleman, unfortunately, even in his early days, took to marijuana smoking and landed up into an asylum and never got out. If he is still alive, he's still in there. His friends sometimes visited him, and he was good enough to play with them just for fun, but he was never good enough to be released. But this man, in his early days, played so advanced clarinet playing that you readily can hear that his understanding must have come from the early recordings of King Oliver with Louis Armstrong and Johnny Dodds.
What did he have influenced later people like Benny
Goodman? Oh, yes. I think practically all of them must got their first cue from Leon Rapolo, and therefore this man was very important in jazz. Golden Leaf Strut. Thank you.
The Golden Leaf Strut from 1926, played by the New Orleans Rhythm Kings, and I kept peering into that texture for the clarinet. He's pretty distant most of the time, but really he had a different tone from what I expected. I expected a Goodman-like tone or a Pete Fountain, but he has his own sound.
Oh, yes, yes. Very much on the minor key, yes. If you know what I mean.
And a very fruity sound, very lovely.
Yeah.
I wish he had a longer solo. Now let's move on then, Ed.
The next recording is by Bert Laun and his loungers. Now, this is strictly a recording front leader's title or name. Bert Laun was a known band leader, all right, but he had little or nothing to do with this particular recording. He might not have even been in the studio, because he never played an instrument anyhow on all his recordings.
Well, maybe he paid their salary.
Yeah, that's possible. The reason why he was possibly picked here is that it is the hot group of Red Nichols, Miff Moore, and the rest of the boys of the Five Pennies group playing on Harmony, which is a Columbia.
That's a reissue on LP, isn't it?
Oh, no, this is very old.
Oh, I'm lost here, because there is a Harmony that was...
No, yeah, I think Columbia just hang on to that name and reused it again. But this is the old Harmony label. Now, the Red Nichols group was strictly a Brunswick group for the Brunswick label. But playing for Columbia, it had to have a different name, so it became Bert Laun's Loungers. Now, what they play here is just one of these old happy tunes, Here Comes My Ball and Chain. What I want you to listen to is Miff Moore. This is one of the finest recordings Miff ever made. And again, although it is an up-tempo, you can hear this sad inner soul in his trombone solo, and Miff does a beautiful job here.
So-called Bert Laun's Loungers, which is really Red Nichols' Five Pennies, I guess, and Here Comes My Ball and Chain from 1927, and we were listening most to Miff Mole, and I just got a piece of tremendous news brought into the studio. Our guest, Ed Cromlin, has never told me the names of his two sons. Mm-hmm. And it derives from his admiration from these early jazz musicians. Tell us about
That's correct. My eldest son is called Bix, after Bix Beiderbecke, and the youngest fella is called Miff, after Miff Moll. So you can see where my early interest really was with.
My heavens, what does your wife think about that?
She accepted the name, so she thought it was all right.
She fought, but she accepted it. I'm delightful. What would you have called a daughter?
Bessie, after Bessie Smith.
Right. That's allowed. I wonder if she would have cared for that, the daughter. Now, here comes my ball and chain. You know, it's funny, just maybe 15 years ago, that would have sounded dated. But now that we see more experience. With the past, it doesn't sound dated.
No.
The Weary Blues. What's this one?
That is by Lud Glushkin. Now, this is particularly an orchestra you may never have heard of. I call him...
Yes.
Oh, you did? Oh, that's...
I always amused by his name because it sounds like a choke. As if your throat was choking. Lud Glushkin.
Lud Glushkin. Now, I call that my little United Nations. Reason for it is that Lud, being a Russian as a little boy, came with his parents to the United States, immigrants, you see, became an American. Then when the First World War came, he went overseas with the troops, I presume, and stayed behind in France, and being a musician, he started up his own band, mostly with French musicians. From there, he went to England, added some English musicians to it, then came back to the continent, and in 1928, I met him in Amsterdam, when he was playing the Carlton Hotel in Amsterdam, and I was there at one of the rehearsals, and it was marvelous to see. This was the Tower of Babylon all over again. Mm-hmm. Nobody understood each other, and it was terrific commotion sometimes. But when it was too fierce, then Lud would just give the downbeat, 1-2, and off they went. And they really understood each other as long as the music was going. But in talk, it was quite a confusion. Now, he went from Holland to Germany, and for a very little recording company, the Homo Chord, he made a few recordings, and they didn't even have a studio, so they recorded everything in the nightclub after the show was over, and so you hear the reverberation of this club. However, what he plays is good, and what I want you to listen to are the two top French musicians in this orchestra, Philippe Brun on trumpet, and Léo Fauchant, the trombone player especially, with a beautiful tone. Now, Jack Hilton, who happened at that time to be the Paul Whiteman of Europe, he heard this band once, and he immediately sent word he wanted those two musicians, and he got them too for a price. But that they stand out as soloists is quite evident on this recording of Weary Blues. Thank you.
Well, you won't have played anything better than that, Ed. I got goosebumps listening to that. It's tremendous. And it's odd. You mentioned that business about being made in the nightclub, didn't you?
Yes.
I think a record dates faster when it's made in a studio, you know, a soundproof studio, than if it's made in a wide open...
A dry recording dates faster. That's a very good observation. Well, it's quite true.
That record, unbelievably enough, 1929.
That's right.
Lud Gluskin and his orchestra, and oh my, it was fabulous, Weary Blues. We have to move on.
Yes, the next recording is by Jack Pettis and his Pets. Now, to every rule there is an exception, and the exception here is that what I always think, good jazz must have an inner soul of sadness, of real nostalgia. Here it is bouncy and a happy sound, and the reason for that is Jack Pettis himself. This tenor sax player, somehow he radiated a happiness. Every recording he is in, there is just this happy sound. And here he is the leader of a pickup band with good men like Jack Teagarden, Benny Goodman, and all in that. But I think all credit in this particular recording goes to the guitar player, Eddie Lang. Eddie Lang, when he was in the studio, you didn't need anybody else in the rhythm section. He did it all. And you should listen to him behind solos like Jimmy McPartland on trumpet and Benny Goodman on clarinet. He's just there all the time. Beautiful chords. And then he takes a little solo at the end.
So we've got Jack Pettis to listen to, and Eddie Lang, mostly sort of among the others.
That's correct.
And the name of the selection?
Is A Bag of Blues.
And that is a happy one. Jack Pettis and his Pets, 1931 Victor in A Bag of Blues. By the way, you were mentioning while one of these records was playing that you've been offered some interesting sums for some of these discs.
I hardly dare to tell you. I've been offered for a few of these old recordings that are really worthwhile, up to $60 a piece. And it's only 3 minutes playing time, but you can't replace them. And And as I sometimes say, money isn't everything. I rather hang on to my record.
Of course. Now, most of the collectors that come to us do this bit, you know, with the second-hand stores and down East Hastings and that sort of thing. You don't do that anymore, do you? You brought most of these from Europe?
Oh, these are all from Europe, yes.
Yes.
I used to go to the Marché de Puces, the flea market in Paris. That's where I spent all my holidays when I was in high school. That's where I picked up most of them.
Are you in the business of collecting now? Or?
Oh, if I can find time, but...
You don't take too much time,
no,
then?
No, no. And it's all opera that I collect nowadays.
No, you've got everything. Original Memphis 5.
Yes, now the emphasis should certainly not be on original, because I've got albums full of the original Memphis 5, and this one is not an original Memphis 5. They had changed many of the personnel in it. But the why I played this recording is that in the St. Louis Gel, which is, by the way, a very, very good melody, Jimmy Dorsey and Tommy Dorsey are both in the studio. I think Tommy Dorsey came in rather late because he only plays the last 10 bars. That's all. You don't hear him before. But I always maintain if he never had played any other music but those 10 bars, he still would be the top pro in my mind, because it is just beautiful trombone playing. Let's listen to it. St. Louis Gel.
I wish you'd warned us that it was a muted trombone. I was listening for another sound. I wasn't just sure what it was. That was Tommy Dorsey in those last few bars.
Yes, and how?
And it was the original so-called Memphis Five with St. Louis Gal from 1932. Red Norvo was one of my favorite people.
Yes, now this will be a little bit of a shock to you, because you may expect again something very, very different. Now, in 1933, I was once, no, 1935, I was invited to England for some talks to the Rhythm Club in London, and they gave me a little program on BBC, and I played this recording, and to my great surprise, this recording made the greatest impact. And I've never heard it by anybody else. It is Dance of the Octopus. And the instrumentation is just...
That's 8 to the var.
It's only 4 people in it, and Benny Goodman plays a bass clarinet. Now, we here in Vancouver are very fortunate that we can see a octopus in action in our beautiful aquarium. And if you look at that animal, this is the finest descriptive music you can possibly imagine. Every move of that octopus is right in this music. And you will agree that they actually were the avant-garde musicians, giving already a hint to what later, say, it was TV music on, say, Sea Hunt of Lloyd Bridges or something like that. This is really advanced, because this goes back into 1933 when this was recorded.
Can you give us an idea of who plays what?
Oh, Benny Goodman is on bass clarinet. And Red Norvo is on marimba, which is a softer type wood xylophone. And then there is a guitar, which is Dick McDonough. And on the bass is Arthur Bernstein. And that's all. But listen to this descriptive music of Dance of the Octopus. Thank you.
From 1933 of Brunswick, of Red Norvo, a marimba, and his group, The Dance of the Octopus. We had everything there, Ed, but the ink. We must move on quickly. I hate to leave that in. Jack Teagarden's one of your favorite people.
That's correct. In the next recording, he plays very little in it himself, but the man to listen to is Kasper Reardon, the harpist.
And
this is the first recording I ever met where a harp was utilized in jazz, and I would say just about the best I've ever heard of any harp playing in jazz. The number they play is Junkman.
Teagarden and his orchestra with Junkman, the Brunswick from 1934, and of course we were emphasizing the thought of the harpist there playing jazz, Kasper Reardon. Now, Ed Crumlin, we'll have to say goodbye after your introduction to this final one and use that as it were, as a fill, but would you say a brief word about our final selection?
Yes, this is of Francis Joseph, much better known as Muggsy Spanier, who just recently, on the February the 12th this year, at the age of 64, passed away. Now, for my money, Muggsy was, after Big Spider Mac, by far the finest white trumpet player ever in the jazz idiom. And I thought it quite appropriate here to end up my program by letting Muggsy play his own elegy in a 12-bar blues theme here called Feather Brain.
And now I'll say that our guest has been Ed Crumlin, who will be back with us again soon. We don't know with what, but something marvelous. And this is Bob Kerr, hoping you enjoyed the record collector, and will join us again next week.